You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Among the more deadly instruments of war deployed by the U.S. military in Iraq and Afghanistan was depleted uranium, a low-level nuclear weapon that has a half-life of 4.5 billion years and been linked to cancer, birth defects, and radiation sickness. Unfortunately, this most recent war was not the first time the military tested DU on the battlefield. It was also in the arsenal during the wars in Kosovo and Afghanistan and has been used on practice bombing ranges on the Puerto Rican island of Vieques. Now add to that list the state of Washington. Through numerous Freedom of Information Act requests, Glenn Milner of the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action has made a shocking discovery that he shared with independent radio producer Mike McCormick.
Depleted uranium is a waste product in the processing of uranium ore, and it's actually the isotope U-238 that's used, that's separated from the natural uranium, and it's waste product, and it's been used starting in the 70s. They began shaping it into bullets. They found that it has a special armor-piercing ability. Actually, what's been discovered in 2000, the Department of Energy has admitted that a lot of the depleted uranium that's been used has not been from the separation process. In fact, it's been after it's been through a nuclear reactor, and so a lot of it's contaminated with plutonium and what's termed as transuranic material, which is heavier than uranium. The term depleted uranium is a little unclear, but it's because there's different types and different materials used, but it's radioactive material that's used in bullets because of its unique abilities to pierce armor. It also has a unique features about it. It can, it actually burns as it hits armor. As far as like Iraqi tanks where it's been used extensively, it actually cuts clean circular holes right through the armor. So as it hits, it tends to burn and creates what's termed as ceramic radioactive particles.
My understanding is it creates this cloud of fine particles, obviously are radioactive particles that everyone in that area, in this case, let's say a tank, then breathes in for those that are surviving the initial hit from the shell.
This stuff becomes airborne, and it has the ability to resuspend in the air as it's disturbed. Depleted uranium has a half-life of 4.5 billion years, so it's virtually forever the material is out there. And it's been linked to illness in the Iraq and other areas where it's been used, birth defects. A lot of our soldiers have been ill in 1991. Probably now... a lot of our soldiers are becoming ill as they stay in Iraq and stay in these areas where it's used.
Heard a statistic from Dr. Doug Rocky that over a third of the U.S. Service people from 91 have applied for disability from things related to this.
The way that I got into depleted uranium is again, researching the Trident issues, and I had made a FOIA request to the Navy regarding hazards for Trident submarines. And it seems hard to believe, but the submarines actually, you know, off the coast of New York a few years ago, a Trident submarine and an attack submarine ran into each other. In Kings Bay in particular, they seem to have difficulty. They've sucked up buoys into the propellers. And so there's been problems, you know, navigation problems with the submarines. And so the request I made here brought this one document in December 2002, which stated one of the navigation warnings to the submarines was to stay clear of this area because the USS Fife, a warship, was firing depleted uranium rounds off the coast of Washington. The information I've gotten largely from the Navy is stating that they don't have records of this.
One of the things that comes up in the media when the Navy is questioned publicly about this is they go out of their way to say that this stuff is totally harmless and doesn't cause a problem.
You know, it's hard to believe, but one record that I got from the Army, which I found pretty amazing, is it's just an MSDS sheet, or Material Safety Data Sheet, from 1984. Should an accident occur or DU corrosion be discovered, clean up and decontamination should be performed only by authorized personnel. again, anyone who has inadvertently come in contact with material that is potentially contaminated with DU should be surveyed for contamination by authorized personnel as soon as possible. Remove any clothing which may be contaminated, wash hands, arms, face, and any other exposed parts of the body with soap and water. Do not eat, drink, smoke, or apply cosmetics before being satisfactorily decontaminated. And also, there was in these records, it showed that there was a person with the Navy who was in charge of Naval Air Command, who specifically was in charge of DU weapons. So that's a totally new area as well, which... trying to find out more on this, but it appears as there's at least three weapon systems with the Navy where they're firing depleted uranium. So, you know, I started looking at how they ship it, how they store it, and I got some documents from the Department of Transportation regarding this, and they actually have an exemption, which is up, incidentally, June 30th, 2004. Hopefully we can kind of mount some sort of effort to keep it from being renewed. What it says is when they ship depleted uranium, when they ship it, they don't have to put radioactive material on the side of the rail car or on the side of the truck. All they have to do is put this number on the side that says DOTE 9649. And then supposedly, if there's an accident, anyone involved would know, I don't know how they would, but they're supposed to know that there's radioactive material involved. You know, I asked the Department of Transportation, just how is it that you could do this, that you could offer an exemption? Because, you know, if it was an accident severe enough where there'd be a fire, quite likely the driver would be incapacitated or unable to communicate what's inside of his truck. You'd have the material would be on fire, and basically you'd have what would be known as a dirty bomb. You'd have radioactive material that's burning, which is exactly, you know, what this MSDS sheet warns us about. You know, when it's in an oxidized state or burning, it becomes suspended in the air and it's radioactive and a very dangerous material. So, and the answer that I got is our request for exemption is based on the needs of the DOD to ship DU munitions in a manner that does not draw attention to the fact that they contain a radioactive component. Well, I mean, it's pretty clear they want to keep it secret.
And another thing that is in that same document, they're talking about it's okay to do this because the Navy has had a rich history of working with DU munitions. And it specifically says the Navy Department has been shipping DU munitions since April 1974 without a transportation accident.
The thing is, in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, in their license, they have to keep very close tabs on it. In fact, if they lose, I think it's something like 43 of these bullets, they lose 43 bullets, they're supposed to file a special report with them to try and determine where, what happened. But, you know, here they're saying there's, you know, they've got a gun that can fire thousands of rounds a minute, and they don't keep track of it. The Coast Guard also has this Phalanx gun on it, this close-in weapon system on a lot of their ships. And so it seemed really unlikely that the Coast Guard would want this because I think they defend our coastline. But I filed a FOIA request with the Coast Guard to see if they handle depleted uranium. And what I got in response was, well, they haven't had a license since 1992 with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, so they're not legally able to handle it since then. But their gun does fire it. And the documents I just got recently from the Coast Guard said in August 2001... the Navy mistakenly shipped 20-millimeter depleted uranium rounds to the Coast Guard in Seattle. And the Coast Guard in August 2001 received 1,700 rounds of this 20-millimeter radioactive bullet, and they loaded it on the U.S. Coast Guard cutter, Mellon. And what I was told was as soon as the Coast Guard realized they had radioactive bullets, they got rid of it. And in the document, they said they returned it to Indian Island, which is the first time I've gotten any documents that said where they store it. So that's one place we know. But anyway, this shows that, you know, the Navy didn't even know they shipped the wrong rounds. And, you know, maybe part of this problem is the fact they use this exemption on their shipping containers where maybe their own people don't know what E9649 stands for. If this stuff was labeled a little better, citizens would know, and probably the Navy would be able to track this a little better too.
Glenn Milner works with the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action. He spoke with independent radio producer Mike McCormick. As Peace Watch approaches its one-year anniversary, we're delving into our archives all this week and presenting some of our favorite and most memorable pieces from our past 252 shows. Here's one of them, produced by Peace Watch correspondent Dan Drum. Dan took a trip a few months ago into the rural community of Mondovi, Wisconsin, to speak with two peace activists and friends, Jenny Klotz and Michael Seisman. I should mention that Mondovi has a population of 2,500, and the busiest intersection is controlled by a four-way stop sign. Several months ago, Jenny found out just how hard it can be to voice dissenting opinions in a small town. Local residents hushed her after she tried to hang an anti-war protest sign outside her apartment window. Jenny asked her friend Michael for support, and together they found a way to make themselves be heard. This is their story.
I live above the store that I work at. The night that, you know, President Bush said we were going to start attacking Iraq, you know, I sat down and I made my banner, which said, "No blood for oil," and I hung it up outside of my living room windows. And I live in an apartment above a business on the busiest street in my small town. So, you know, I thought it's a good idea, you know, everybody would see it. In my experience, you know, seeing other people's signs and talking to other people, my viewpoint was molded. And I thought, you know, that it was important to get as many viewpoints out there as possible.
She had made the sign, "No Blood for Oil," and she put it outside of her apartment, which is above Malum's Pharmacy. And her employer, he said, she called him and said, "Is this okay?" And he's like, "As long as you make sure that nobody thinks it's associated with Malum's, it's fine." But then as the day went on, there was so much harassment, people coming into her place of work and yelling at her, one guy in particular, a veteran. People were calling, you know, just raising such a stink about this, that it got to the point where her employer told her to put it out back.
The first man who came in to complain showed up in, you know, his VFW coat and his hat and things, and he brought in this piece of paper and he just said, "You know, I printed this off. You know, I want you to know we buried a veteran today and I want you to read this." And it was all, you know, run off on American flag paper. And I said to him, I said, "You know, my home address is blah 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 blah. My phone number is blah 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 blah. If you want to mail it to me, you can, and I will read it. Or if you want to call me up and read it to me over the phone, you can. But you cannot come to my place of work and harass me." And people are calling, asking to talk to the pharmacist, and it's not his job to, you know, field questions about this. So I told him, I said, "If anyone else calls about it, give them my home phone number. Tell them to call me. It's not your responsibility to answer their questions. It's nothing you did. It's my responsibility. Don't talk to anyone about it." He basically said that if I refused to take it down, that he would kick me out of the apartment, that I wouldn't leave him any other choice. And he also, you know, kind of veiled, in a veiled manner, said that I could lose my job because, you know, I was offending customers.
So then she put it out back. The harassment still continued. So they said, "Just take it down or you're going to be fired and you're going to be kicked out of your apartment." So she had to do it because she doesn't really have anywhere else to go and, you know, you need a job.
The hardest thing to do in a small town is to have an opinion unless it's, you know, the one given opinion of the people. Actually, I feel more than just a little bad about, you know, buckling under and taking it down because, you know, I've never really been afraid to say what I want to say. Like, I crumbled under pressure. I'm not, you know, pretending I didn't, but at this point, I don't have anywhere to go.
Then she finished the day at work, and then when she got home, she called me, and she's like, "Should I do something about this? Should we, is there anything?"
I called up a friend of mine, Michael Seisman, because we had both gone to the rally in Madison, and I knew that she, you know, since she's a university student, she would have connections with groups up there.
I think I sent out a total of 3 emails to everybody, and then there were just a few, you know, not just a few, there were actually quite a few people who wrote back.
It went into play that we were going to have, you know, an anti-war demonstration.
I've never organized a demonstration or anything. I didn't even know what I was doing the whole time. The first people to appear were some of the women in black, and you know, they set up in their corner, and we kind of decided that we were going to just take over the four corners of downtown. And as I stood there, more people started coming up, and we passed out extra signs to people who didn't have signs. It was all pretty peaceful. We weren't really chanting or yelling. We were just holding our signs. The people driving by, some people were honking, some people were yelling, starting to yell. Then these two guys came out of the bar. One had a cowboy hat on and Garth Brooks style shirt, and the other one had a Budweiser racing jacket.
So what's your wonderful sign say? Oh, isn't that fantastic?
What's your sign say? Oh.
Budweiser.
Budweiser.
You goddamn right.
And they just started shouting at us about everything we own comes from Iraq, and they were soon joined by veterans holding American flags and yelling at us that, you know, we're protesting against, you know, the American flag, which we were really supporting.
There are so many good, you know, intelligent, factual arguments against this war. And the only opposition we were getting was just unintelligent shouting.
You're getting nothing. You're doing nothing. You're a fucking idiot!
People in that town, it's like as soon as you say anything against the war, you're against the troops, you're against the government, you're against the president, you're against God.
Let's just all go home. At least pray. You'd do more good by praying.
Let's stand someplace. Stand in front of that car.
We'll wait till
a big old rig comes rolling through 18-wheelers. Stand on front of that. See what they say about your big old protest.
It just really made me mad. Like, I kind of started yelling back a little bit, and, you know, it was hard not to. I shut up after a minute, because, like, you realize that there's really no point in, like, trying to talk to these people, because they're not trying to talk, they're not going to listen to what you have to say. And
100%, right or wrong, stand behind them. Right or wrong. We stand behind our president, because he's our president, he's our king. We bow to our king.
It would have been more difficult if they were making intelligent argument, or if I could see a point to what they were saying, or if I could see that they knew what they were saying.
You don't think we're bombing cities?
Accidentally, you know, missiles do accidentally miss range and go different places. Well, that's what war is about. You know, accidents do happen. We're trying to blow up their shit so they don't attack us, kill you, and blow up this whole town with a 747 airplane.
You know, I just...
Because they're cycle fuckers.
The hardest part for me about, you know, the whole demonstration was I knew when provoked, it's very hard for me to keep my mouth shut. And when those guys just came stumbling out of the bar, you know, with beers in their hands...
What about the other countries that want to control the oil? What's up, bro? What about them? What about Russia? What about Germany? What about all those countries that want to control the oil? They're over there backing us up because we want to free their country from that dumbass that's putting their civilians behind them. Putting bags over our head and shooting us.
You don't know enough about the
because our mechanics are over there fixing stuff that's breaking down. And they're shooting us, putting bags over our head and shooting us. And our guys don't even have no guns.
You're just supporting a Hitler. That's what you're supporting. A Hitler.
Shouting about how we were supporting a Hitler. But then alternately he would shout something about kill all the Iraqis or we should blow them all up. It's like, so what's so wrong with Hitler if you agree with mass murder based on ethnicity or, you know?
And we're giving them food. Dumbass United States country. I wouldn't give no country food that we're fighting with. I would let them fuckers starve. You know, women that are all covered up in stuff over their face. They can't show their face because that's their stuff that they can't do.
If someone can sit down with me and talk to me intelligently about why we need this war, I'm more than willing to talk. But these people, Their argument was built on a lot of just insulting one-liners.
They threatened us with nuclear warheads that they found over there that could kill us all within 2 weeks.
And they could drop it on us, but we're trying to take it away.
Yes.
And I guess that is kind of difficult, that it was all just coming out of sheer ignorance, and then you think about the masses of people who are under the same impressions.
We support our troops just as much as anyone else.
My ass you do. What the hell are you doing standing here then?
Supporting the troops. What support?
No, you are not supporting the troops.
We want them here safe.
Well, yeah, everybody wants them here safe.
So what's the problem?
You gotta take his ass out.
No, it wasn't difficult. It was just I was a little worried about, you know, an outbreak of violence against anybody. Actually, a woman did come up and grab the girl standing next to me, and I had grabbed her hand. I had to, pry her hand off the girl and be like, hands off.
Yeah, but see, you're sort of right. You said you figured that if you would protest this war, you think that you would stop it. But see, I'm a Vietnam veteran like some of these other guys are, and we've seen what the protesters did. They, you know, we were trying to fight for democracy and kick out the communists, you know, and it was sort of a long, complicated issue. But this here, it's a simple issue of he dishonored the UN resolution and didn't obey it. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, he killed hundreds of thousands of his people, just like Hitler did. So this is a completely different situation. And what you're doing in this situation, you're trying to use that kind of concept to stop the war. But actually what you're doing, the reality is you're supporting Hussein's regime and prolonging it every day that you're protesting.
We had, I'd say, at least 4 local police cars from Mondovi. We had the sheriff himself driving around. We had, a sheriff's deputy. We had state patrol. We had police from Durand. We had police from Pepin County.
What are you coming down and trying to stir up a hornet's nest in a little town like Mondovi?
Soon, more citizens from Mondovi in support of these people showed up. But I have to say that their numbers did not match ours. Maybe half, but I don't even think they had half the people we had out there.
Just today, I went to the bank, and there was a girl who was a couple years younger than me. And, you know, she said, I saw you guys out there on Sunday, you know, and had I, you know, not been with my parents, I think I might have actually come and stood with you for a while, at least talk to you guys. I've overheard, you know, negative comments, too, about, you know, did you see the protesters on Sunday? You know, they think they're something special, you know, and everything. It's been mixed. It's been mixed.
I don't know. In the end, I feel that Jenny and I both felt that it was a success just because, you know, there was such a reaction. People did see. I mean, that's what the whole point was to be seen and let them know that we're supported, and they definitely know that now.
My personal goal was just to spark conversation within the community, because, you know, if people talk about what happened, that's enough. I just wanted people to realize that there was opposition out there, that there was another way of thinking.
You cannot control, you 20 people cannot control what is going on in Afghanistan, what is going on in Iraq. So what's the point? You're wasting your time.
It is so hard. It is so hard to convince people to speak out against something in a small town. It really is, even if they believe it.
We both were realizing that we're in a small rural area, and we weren't the only two. I mean, there's teachers in the school, there's students in the school there, and certain, you know, other citizens of Mondovi had come up to her and, you know, kind of quietly, oh, yeah, I believe that. But everyone was just so worried about the backlash. I mean, just seeing the harassment that she experienced or hearing about it, you hear about these things really fast in a small town. So we just wanted to, for the people who are too nervous to speak about it on their own, we just wanted to show that there are places, or there are other people, not just maybe in Mondovi, but near enough to feel that you're supported with these views. And then also for the people in Mondovi who are trying so hard to just, suppress Jenny's ideas and feelings, that, you know, she's not alone, and you can't just quiet that. You know, there's other people, and you can't, maybe you can stop one voice for a day, but we'll be here, and we'll stand behind each other, you know, very strongly, so.
I love the United States. It's just right now she's kind of troubled. You know, it's like a friend that's really messed up. You don't just, you know, give her one or two chances and then walk out on her when she's falling apart. You have to stay there. You have to love it and see her through things. And that's what I'm doing, you know?
Jenny and I, like, afterwards we went up to her apartment. And I wasn't quite sure. Like, I felt myself that it was pretty good. I felt good afterwards. And I asked Jenny in her apartment, I was like, is that what you wanted? I mean, is that what you were looking for? And she said, yeah, that's exactly what I had in mind. That makes me feel a lot better. I told her she should put her sign back out.
Jenny Klotz and Michael Simon spoke with Peace Watch correspondent Dan Drum. After the protest, Jenny was invited to appear on TV and radio shows in neighboring cities and received a stack of postcards from people supporting her efforts. Last we heard, her landlord had issued her an eviction notice, which she intended to fight. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is T from the Pattersons, taking the train to Tibet. It's your financial support that makes Peace Watch possible. So we urge you to make a generous donation through our secure online website at pacifica.org, or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.